Podcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first part of the show here, we'll be talking about the PhD. And what it's for, how people think about it, what it qualifies one for. We have two guests here in the show, on the show this morning to help us with that. Marisa Narod is director of the Center for Innovation and Research in Graduate Education at the University of Washington at Seattle, where she is also associate dean of the graduate school there. Also with us here in the studio is Rebecca Bryant. She's director of the Career Services Office of the Graduate College of the University of Illinois. Marisa Narod is here to speak. She, in fact, is the keynote speaker at a program that will be taking place this afternoon, a symposium on graduate education. They're calling Challenges, Choices, Careers. We'll talk a little bit about that, and I'm sure that anyone who is listening to us on the campus should feel welcome to take part in this. And also, we'll be talking about some of the research that Marisa Narod has done, looking at job prospects for people who have PhDs, depending upon what it is their field of study is. And then going beyond that and asking a kind of a larger question about, well, what exactly does having a PhD qualify one for? And I think that one of the points that she really wants to make is that one shouldn't think only of a PhD as something that prepares you to go on to be a college professor, that there are other things that you can do. And in fact, maybe you can make the argument that it's a good thing to have a well-educated populace. And it wouldn't be such a bad thing if we had more Americans who had advanced degrees. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of your listeners is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But anybody's welcome to join the conversation, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
I wanted to start and have Marisa Narod talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done. It's gotten quite a lot of attention. A number of years ago, you undertook this study to look at people who got PhDs in a number of fields, in the sciences, in the humanities, to ask this question, well, what happened to these folks in terms of their job prospects, particularly whether or not there were people who were working in their chosen field and in higher academics, higher education, the kind of thing I guess we would expect for people who had PhDs. If your mindset is that a PhD means you're going to go on to become a college professor. Tell us about that study.
Yes, it was a study of nearly 6,000 PhDs from 61 U.S. universities, and we chose from each of the major fields of study one discipline, so biochemistry, computer science and electrical engineering, mathematics, political science, and English. So you have from each of the major field one. And we did a survey 10 to 14 years after they received their PhD, asking them in the survey about their career paths from the time they got their PhD till the time of the survey. And we asked them about a retrospective evaluation of their doctoral education. Specifically, what did they think? Was it useful now since they have been 10 years out and have applied what they were doing? And this was one of the key intentions. I felt very strongly that you need to really be out there and see the world and apply what you do in order to say something about it. And then ask them, what were the difficulties? How did they go about finding a job? But also, what can they recommend present students to do? And it was not only a very long survey, but I also traveled at that time up and down the country and interviewed people, because it's so important to hear why are they doing what they're doing.
Hmm. Well, I think probably one of the one of the headlines on the study, at least the thing that strikes me, probably struck a lot of people, was about what happened to people who got their PhDs in English. Because apparently something like less than way fewer than half of them actually ended up getting tenure track jobs in English, going on and becoming tenured English professors. And how does that compare the experiences of the people who were in the humanities? Particularly, how does that compare with people that were in the hard sciences? Because I guess you would think probably chances are you would have a better chance if you had a PhD in physics or in electrical engineering or in biochemistry or something like that than if your PhD was in English or French or history or
math,
one of those kinds of,
you know, or math, political science, political theory.
Yeah.
Actually, you will be surprised. It's the opposite. First, 10, 14 years later, about 60% of all the people in English ended up and were faculty. Hmm. However, I think where one of the myths already is that everybody want to become faculty, and that's not true. However, the subtle culture is often so that doctoral students don't dare saying that they really do not want to become a faculty. So what we looked at this and did at the study, we asked, what was your career goal when you completed your PhD? And indeed in English, because that's what they think is the norm, nearly 80% wanted to become a professor. But of those who wanted to become a professor, actually 70% did become a professor. So that's something which we also need to ask, and often it's not asked. But in terms of science and engineering, only 30% are professors, because that's also what they only want to be. And interestingly, it always historically has been that people, also about 25% of all the people in the humanities, are not professors. However, the myth which perpetuates since really 100 years now, and I'm just reading, loving history, I'm just reading from 1905, the first kind of survey about PhDs, is that they all become professors. And it was never the case, and it's still not the case. So in science, mathematics is a little bit different. There you have about 60% ending up as professors. In engineering, it's 30%. And in the bioscience, it's about less than half. And I would say nowadays, even with the biotech industry, it's even fewer.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe then I should ask a different sort of question about what it is that people are doing professionally. Now, and one could expect that, for example, if you had a PhD in one of the hard sciences, maybe you were in computer engineering or you were in biochemistry or something like that, that you could go on to become a university professor, or there should be opportunities for employment in private industry, working in your chosen field. So if you ask that question, you ask, well, is the job that you're doing now, 10 or 15 years after you got your PhD, directly related to what it was you studied, then what happens, particularly again when you take a look at people in the humanities and people in the sciences?
Okay. There's one assumption. I mean, first I want to say no one drives taxi, no one drives buses, as the media always want to let us believe.
So that's very comforting to any English graduate students right. Listening. They won't end up driving cabs.
Right. And I can tell I won a whole case of champagne because one of the deans betted with me and said, I'm sure you'll find some English PhD who drive taxi. I did not. Nor did I found only one of those perpetual postdocs who 10 years later are still postdocs in the science. Mm-hmm. The assumption, what you say, is being still in the field is really an assumption which for the 21st century is not a right one anymore. A PhD is there to train people to become knowledgeable in and know how to find information and to know how to search a problem and to be very flexible and to apply it to a wide domain of information, because our problems have become so big that not one single person can solve it. But you need PhDs who really think in broad term and can communicate with others. So only narrowly looking, if someone who has gotten a PhD in biochemistry And 10 years later, is still in that particular biochemistry small area that did their PhD. That is really not what we want to do. We want to people that they are able with the skills to operate in various fields. That does not mean a biochemist would then teach English. Mm-hmm. But so there is a variety of possibilities people have out there, and I would say specifically also in the humanities and the social science.
Well, see, to me, I think that goes against my image of what graduate study is about and what I expect a lot of people's images would be, that as one continues with graduate study and you move closer and closer to the PhD, your field of interest and expertise precipitously narrows to the point where when you get your PhD, you are, with your dissertation, you're becoming an expert in something that maybe nobody else knows anything about or very little. I mean, that's supposed to be the idea of the dissertation, is that it's an exhaustive piece of research on something that hasn't carefully been examined. That would seem to argue against the idea that what you're turning out here is a person who is a thinking person first and primarily, and not somebody who has become an expert on some very small piece of whatever their field is.
The important thing is really the process. Indeed, the PhD is an exercise where you drill deep at one point. Mm. And you become, and you know that one point. But the most important is that in the process, you learned how to approach what's a problem, what hasn't been done, what's solved, how to go about studying it and know the right methodology to studying, and then bringing it all together in a reasonable time. And the skills you learned, there are the skills then which we hope you have to then approach other problems. And in fact, even in the science where you rush, you know, you're in 5 years gladly out, it's long enough, you then can learn another methodology, but you have the skills for the process and you apply it to others. Mm-hmm. So that's the key thing. We don't want someone who only is this minute expert in one tiny thing.
We have a caller here, and I want to get them into the conversation. They're on a cell phone, so let's do that. We'll go right there to line number one. Hello.
Hello. I think the analysis is far too general and shallow in the following way. First, we shouldn't combine the engineering with the physical sciences or the biological sciences. Engineering is a different animal altogether. Secondly, when you're talking about what you do after your PhD, what you're primarily doing in the sciences is you want to do research. And a lot of people who can't get into the top-ranked schools like Illinois and MIT, et cetera, they don't want to go to the University of, I won't say what university, a small university that doesn't have research facilities. They need to be, they'd rather go and make a lot more money, for example, at Exxon than go to the University of South Dakota, which was an experience I had with one of my students. And what they said is all universities are not universities. Science and engineering are extremely grant-dependent fields. And so when you can't get to a school where you can get grants, then you might shift to the university. I think in addition, that at least the training that I've done with my students and others, we don't train students to be broad. They learn their broad education as undergraduates, and then they come in and they specialize in research, and we don't tend to get them to broaden their knowledge, because what they are basically the lab techs. They're the people who do the in-lab work that's responsible for our getting our grants so we can go to conferences and get summer salaries. But I think it's really hard to make any broad generalization. If you have a degree in English, what do you need to do? We have a university that has a library, or do you just need internet access? Certainly high-energy physicists, and I'll hang up with this, are very underemployed in high-energy physics and do a lot of postdocs. And it turns out, it seems that most of them end up on Wall Street doing mathematical analysis. And that's primarily because of the facilities that are needed to work in high-energy physics. So I think the analysis has to be more specific. When we get general, we're sort of losing a lot of what we need. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you want to comment on any of what the caller had to say?
Yes, I want to comment. This is we hear often, and I see very much an issue is with the culture also in our graduate school, that students feel they're only accepted if they become professors in a top rank institution. And the reality is not. In our studies, indeed, it was not all discipline, and it was 61 university, major research universities. About altogether, only 16% end up at major research universities. So I feel very much what's also a duty of the department and the advisor and mentor to inform the students that not everybody gets to a top-ranked school. But one can do very good research, and one can do very good research everywhere. And really inform also that, yes, one has, as a faculty, various roles. One is in the science, as you rightly said, more or less an entrepreneur. One has to bring in a lot of outside money. And therefore, giving a clear picture so students during their doctoral study really can examine whether they want to become a faculty or whether they want to do research and really do this wonderful, exciting bench research in a national laboratory or in a other non-profit laboratory or in a for-profit setting. And I think that's what the symposium today will say, that we need to prepare early on and pass on real information and real data to students about what has happened to the prior students and not only individual anecdote about some disgruntled people.
Hmm. Let me reintroduce our guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. We're speaking with Maresi Narad. She is director of the Center for Innovation and Research in Graduate Education at the University of Washington, Seattle. She's also associate dean of the graduate school there. And also here in studio with us is Rebecca Bryant, who is director of the Career Services Office at the Graduate School. The Graduate College here at the University of Illinois. And Maresi Narad is here to talk at a symposium on graduate education, looking at some of the challenges and choices and careers. This is taking place this afternoon, beginning at 1 in the Illini Union, and she will be the keynote speaker. She'll speak at 1:15, and I think, again, anyone who is interested on the campus who would like to hear what she has to say or take part in this should just go on by. I'd like to bring Rebecca Bryant in the conversation because I'm wondering about the Career Services Office. And in fact, is this the kind of a place where if, for example, you were getting your PhD in English and you were wanted to think about what you were going to do afterwards, and you were interested in possibilities other than going on to become a professor of English somewhere, is that what your office is about, to help people think about what they're going to do when they finish?
Yeah, our office was really conceived of last year through the work of the Career Advisory Committee assigned by Graduate Dean Richard Wheeler. It was a committee, you know, composed of faculty, career professionals, and graduate students to explore the career trajectories and the advice that students received from faculty and staff at the University of Illinois regarding their career possibilities. And our office was really designed and created to help students have a place to come that can help them identify alternative paths or to identify, you know, just what kind of career path and future is going to best suit their goals. And, you know, also within our office, there's kind of an acceptance that the PhD is excellent training for academia, but it also is training for a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm. I really want to say it's not an either or, and it's very important for people to see what do they value in life, what kind of lifestyle also do they want to live. And for some, it may be they really want to be faculty, and that's perfect, and that's what everybody in the university would love them and will help them and an office help them to do. But for some, there are all a lot of other possibilities out there. And as I said, a democracy as this one, we need people who are smart, who know how to get information, how to convey complicated information to a diverse audience, to people out there. So we need anywhere, we need good researcher in society.
And I'm sure also it would be reasonable to expect that people would want to make a living. And graduate education, going through a PhD, it's hard work. And it can take a number of years out of your life, and it can be expensive. You might end up with debts, and you know. So you, at the end of it, you want to actually have something that's worth something. So I guess I wonder how many people, you know, do approach that issue and say, well, maybe this is something that I would like to do, and I think that I have the ability, and I think that I have the desire. But what happens afterwards? And if, particularly if there's some uncertainty about, as we've said, so in the past, maybe the automatic idea was, well, I can go and I can get a job at some college somewhere. But if there's any uncertainty about that, I can imagine a lot of people looking at the possibility of graduate study and saying, well, what's the point?
Well, one thing I have to say to this question is generally people who do a PhD are not the people who want to make huge amount of money. They want to live and live reasonable well. But so if you want to do that, these are not people. But indeed, say, take the example of English PhD, what we found, that those who are working in business, government, or nonprofits actually on the average earn more than faculty. So you may also think about it. In other fields, as we know, in engineering, it varies, but it's more equal. But yes, you have a good chance and you earn well outside. And one other thing I want to point out in terms of job satisfaction, of all, when we looked at the time of survey completion, so 10, 14 years later, and asked people, you know, about their satisfaction, various indicators, we found actually as a group, the most satisfied were the CEOs, and not on money terms. That's what people say. Of course, they make a lot of money. No, on criteria which are often attributed to academic life and to academia, and that is autonomy of work, intellectual challenge, and also career growth. And these were the criteria CEOs and then managers, who were the second group, were most satisfied, and only third-ranked faculty. So one may think about it, about faculty life in a realistic picture, but it's also exciting.
I don't mean to pick on the English grad students, but you talked about the study that you did, looking at the people who got their PhDs and then looking 10 years later and looked at what people were doing. And you said that something like 60% of the English PhDs were actually English professors. That 40% that were not, what sort of things were those people doing?
For example, a number were working in public affairs offices, were the public affairs office of a state, of an attorney general. A number of them were indeed in publishing houses. A number were independent consultant writing. There was quite a good number with English who were in the universities, but in what we call higher education administration. There were dean of students. There were dean of extension. And actually, those had a higher salaries than some of the faculty and really felt that they can combine a more reasonable a family life with a career. And that's a whole other topic. Of really family and career and the PhD.
Mm-hmm. So when you, I don't know if you did this, but if you asked the people in the study, if you had it to do all over again, would you do your PhD? Would you do it in the field that you did? Would you do something different? Would you choose some different field? I mean, basically, if you asked people that basic question, would you do it all again? What did most people say?
In fact, we did ask a question, and it was, to my surprise, a high proportion, nearly 80% said, say in English, they would do it over again and would do a PhD in English. So, yes, even if there was a hard time about finding a job, but the love of the field was right there, and they will do it again. Mm-hmm. They may want to look perhaps a different career, but they will do it again. Yeah.
Do you want to, I wonder if, Rebecca Bryant, you'd like to talk a little bit more about this event that's happening sure. this afternoon? As I expect that there will be people listening. I hope there will be people listening who would be interested and might want to take part.
Right. Well, we're really excited about this afternoon's event. We're going to start at 1, and Dr. Narad's going to start shortly thereafter with her keynote address, really talking about her research about the PhD and the career trajectories of PhDs. After that, we're going to complement that with a panel, an alumni panel. We're bringing back several alumni from a diversity of disciplines, history, education, physics, who have had successful careers outside the academy, and have them talk a lot about how they got there. And we're calling this panel actually Transferable Skills, or How Did I Get Here? And we expect that to be really very interesting. And I hope that this will also be really very interesting for the students and, you know, the graduate students who are coming to be kind of, just kind of sketches in different ways, just lots of different paths, because very often people don't know what else is out there and aren't thinking about other things. We have 3 concurrent focus sessions begin at 3:20. And the topics that are being discussed are the challenges that couples face, professional couples, especially academics, face in trying to manage career and family issues. And that's something we hear a lot about from our students. And then a second session on another panel of faculty and staff, just talking about, the different milestones, if you will, of a career within academia, from graduate student to postdoc, to assistant professor, to getting tenure, and then so on. And then the last thing is we're actually piloting a workshop that our office will hopefully be doing in future semesters that is intended to help students start thinking early about planning, career planning, and identifying alternative, lots of different things that they can do, and to find the ways that they'll be best fulfilled. Hmm.
All right. So this is going on this afternoon, starting at 1 at the Illini Union in rooms A and B, mm-hmm. Symposium on Graduate Education Challenges, Choices, Careers. And again, I'm assuming that anybody who's interested can just show up.
Absolutely. Right. Everyone's welcome.
All right. And here, questions are welcome to 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask you something that I think probably you're also interested in, and that is the issue of retention for people who go into graduate education. And it's my understanding that of the people who start PhDs, about half at some point drop out. They don't finish. They don't make it all the way. I'm sure there are a lot of people who, and I'm not sure what percentage this would be, but I imagine a significant number of people manage to get all the coursework done, but then the big hurdle is the dissertation. And they end up with, in the field, is called ABD, which means all but dissertation. They somehow can't get over that last big thing, which can be very difficult and lonely and challenging undertaking. What do you think about the retention issue and why it is that so many people start graduate education but don't finish?
Let me give you some empirical facts about this attrition, which are often not so known. While it's correct, although one doesn't have national numbers, but I can say of one of my former institutions, overall it's about 50% only complete, but it varies enormously by field. So you have in the science and engineering nearly 70% completing. It's indeed in those fields, humanities and social science, where there is very little financial or not as much financial support as in others, and where the time to degree is fairly long because the studies are very long, more and more is added on, and people earn their money by being TAs or by doing other work, so the time to degree is long. It's that's where the a lot of people, half of them drop out. Now, it's unlike what we commonly believe, that it's all those ABDs. Actually, the majority of people who leave early on. They leave in year 1 to 3 before advancement to candidacy often. And as here I'm speaking with my head as a graduate dean, I would say actually that's, if one leaves, that's good leaving, because both the individual hasn't invested that much of their own money and pain, as well as the institution. And I think it's often, I've done a study about in my institution of this, and what I found is, A, sometimes students, doctoral students, really have not done their homework and found out that this is not the right institution where they study, because the person they wanted to study with has left the institution and they didn't look what's going on, although now with the web that's less so. Graduate student life is not what they wanted and liked. And this was often a case for people who had worked outside and come back. But also the happened that the thought of becoming a faculty and seeing academic life is not what they really aspire to. But indeed, there is those ABDs, and I think that's unfortunate, and that has, as I said, to do something with money, but it has also to do that the process of getting a PhD has not become clear, and indeed, specifically in humanities and social science, in those days when you don't take courses anymore, and these are fields where you often do the research alone in the library or in the field. It gets isolating, gets hard. And I think there where a good graduate program and good mentorship can kick in, can help. And that's why also when you know you have a job at the other end and you have a goal and a strategy how to get there, it really, A, shortens time, but also it keeps people in the program. And I think more and more awareness has come to that.
Yeah. I don't know if it's useful to break this down into really fine categories, but I guess I'm curious about the when you look at the people who drop out at some point, how many people would say, I think as I learn more about this field, suddenly I realize, no, this isn't what I'm interested in, or this isn't the kind of life I wanted, and they just completely dropped out of the advanced degree enterprise, or in how many people were in this other category that either they said, I want to continue, but I want to go someplace else, or maybe I even want to go into a different field, and I want to go on, I do want to get a PhD, but instead of getting a PhD in this area, I want to go and do it in this area.
You're totally correct. Now, unfortunately, I cannot give you, really general statistics, only at one university. And this was what I found. The majority really changed field, and they didn't drop out of graduate study altogether. What I found interestingly, that a number of students of color, so say who were in a biochemistry, in a molecular biology, felt, I really want to study law. I want to help and pay back to my community what I've gotten, and move towards a more applied field. And many see in law, I can pay back. And so, yes, we are not losing them. And the one I interviewed at the institution where I used to be really said it was painful and it was terrible leaving, but it was worthwhile. I learned a lot. And yes, they're continuing in some another form the study.
Well, questions are certainly welcome, and we'll be here for about another 20 minutes in this part of Focus. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455 with our guest, Maracy Narad from the University of Washington at Seattle. She's Associate Dean of the Graduate School there, and Rebecca Bryant, who is Director of the Career Services Office in the Graduate College of the U of I. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly over the last couple of years, universities have been facing difficult times, both public and private universities. The public ones, the state budgets are in terrible shape, and they've seen a lot of cuts in their funding. And then the private ones, the ones that depend on endowments, they're not doing much better because their stock portfolios haven't been doing well. So there's been a lot of retrenchment and shrinking of programs. And faculty have been let go and the number of classes have contracted. And I'm sure that it's led people in higher education administration all over to think about what it is they're doing and how they do it. I mean, a time when there has been that kind of contraction of the institutions, and I'm sure that there's even greater and greater pressure. People are thinking about, well, okay, what am I going to do? Am I going to go out and try to get a job? Am I going to go to graduate school? Then if I go to graduate school, what kind of job am I going to have when I finish? Does this lead you and other people who are in higher ed administration think about what graduate education is all about? Should it be somehow changed? Should it be made different? Do you have to make it more attractive? Do you have to make the period from start to finish a little faster? Do you have to take a more pragmatic approach so that, for example, maybe what you have to do if you're trying to recruit people is to say to them, look, we're going to help you figure out what you're going to do when you finish? You know, how does the place that we are now in higher education, how does that affect the way people think about this whole enterprise of graduate school?
Yes, you hit directly on the right point. In these times, there really has become a national movement among graduate deans and graduate school to have a fresh look at the PhD. So you'll hear there are events like rethinking the PhD, re-envisioning the PhD. What needs to be done is really focusing also what is not offered with the very good scholarly study which is given. And there are a lot of there are issues for professional socialization. And that is what we try in various graduate schools around the country to help to be a catalyst like this one today, that students also, why they get an excellent scholarly education, which we need, as I said in the beginning, learn how to work in teams, learn something about grant writing, and learn about presentation skills, learn about publishing, and learn about organization and managerial skills, not in the narrow sense, because that they learn better in industry, but learn overall how to manage a project. And I think this is where we need to move forward in the 21st century. And rather than saying, oh, we have too many PhD, and I really want to say, looking at Europe has decided in the Bologna Treaty, we are in a global world, and we need to have our knowledge workers are global workers, and therefore they need the best education we can get and increasing the production of PhDs. So I think here in the U.S., we should not move the opposite way in saying, let's cut it, it's too expensive, they don't get a job, but rather thinking, what in addition do they need that they become professionals in all areas of society. Mm.
Well, there I think you put your finger on a big issue here in the United States, and that's the cost. And one of the big differences when you make comparisons between Europe and the United States is how much it costs to go to college. If the cost continues to go up, and as it has, and I guess we expect that it's going to continue to do that, how do institutions deal with that?
Well, at my institution, the University of Washington, it's one of them, a state where you don't have income tax, where the higher education or all of education is very much under pressure and a crunch. The university has put a lot of effort into raising money elsewhere. Now, nearly every college, like including the graduate school, has its own full-time development officer. And we try to bring and help, in that case, our graduate students with money we try to raise from everywhere. So also the humanities and social science have fellowship. And we try to target the financial support at these critical hurdles. As you know, the science and engineering are all supported all through the graduate study. And the others, we try to see that they have a fellowship when they write the dissertation, that they have a fellowship when it comes to the general exam, but otherwise they are teaching assistantship. So we really try to think strategically and creatively how to support them best.
Hmm. I'm wondering, Rebecca, when people come into your office and talk about what it is that worries them and concerns them and what sort of things are most on their mind, what things do they worry about? I mean, are they just thinking about getting from one day to the next, and are they worried about finances, or is it really that they're focused on the end result and concerned about where they're going to be or where they're going?
A lot of it depends upon where the student is in their educational process. If a student's still fairly early, they may not be thinking too much. Unfortunately, a lot of students don't begin thinking about, kind of thinking pragmatically, if you will, about their careers until they're, you know, 6, 12 months away from being completed. And then there's this kind of just-in-time kind of approach to addressing things. Very often students come in and they're really concerned about the job market. Particularly those students who are trying, who are dedicated to pursuing a career as a professor in academe, and especially those students in the humanities, I think really feel that these days. But also many of those same students, and including many of the students who may be saying, you know, I don't think I'm going to finish my PhD, and I don't want to be a professor, I've changed my mind, or I am going to finish my PhD and I still don't want to do this. They really have the sense that they don't have any real world skills. And it's really a lot of what we can do and do with students is really talk to them about what we usually call as transferable skills. Mm-hmm. And it's those basic things that all employers want. You know, English majors, we typically think, communicate well. Most of them generally, you know, write pretty well and can communicate well. Certainly anyone who's spent much time working as a teaching assistant has probably developed their ability to explain a complex concept to people. Employers everywhere need this. They need people who can see the big picture, but who also can be detail-oriented. So we can work. We often work with students, and actually for graduate students listening who might be interested in this, we have a couple workshops next week, Wednesday and Thursday night, and you can check our website for it, talking about transferable skills and working with students to just identify the kinds of things that they are good at, because it isn't always apparent. You know, that you might say, hey, I have a PhD in musicology, but what does that mean for my ability to communicate with the rest of the world? And actually, spoken to someone who does have a PhD in musicology, it enables, you know, students learn a lot along the way about a lot of different things. They get great skills. Hmm.
Do you then, now based on knowing, picking up from graduate students this concern about lack of real world skills, do you then report back to the people who are on the other end of this, in the educational enterprise, the teachers and the deans and the administrators, and say, now look, what the graduate students that I talk to are telling me this and this and this, and that this is what they're looking for, so that needs to be incorporated in the teaching. Does that feedback into the institution and end up showing up, or would you like that to show up in what it is that students are doing in their classroom experience and in their research?
Let me see if I understand what you're asking. My sense, I guess, is that the transferable skills are things you pick up along the way while you're learning to become an expert as a musicologist or as a historian. That they're kind of intrinsic, and maybe as Marisi said, you can learn managerial skills in other ways, but completing a dissertation is a managerial enterprise. And you are not only a manager, you are a manager of yourself. So in a lot of ways, students gain these skills along the way. I would personally not necessarily favor or endorse changing, I guess, the nature of academic programs. I mean, at least at this point. I don't know what Maurice has to say
about that. So it sounds like what you're saying is that what you would say to the graduate student is that, well, this is something you need to think about and, to, in a sense, teach yourself as you're learning whatever it is you're learning. Don't expect your professors to help you with this. That's something that you're going to have to do for yourself.
Yes. I believe the students must take a certain amount of responsibility. But, you know, I think that's true whether you're a PhD, a student, or I think that's just kind of a fact of life that you need to say, well, hey, what is it I want? Mm-hmm. And, okay, where do I want to be and how am I going to get there? And address students, whether you're planning a career as an academic or other, you're responsible for your own professionalization.
We have about 8 or 9 minutes left, and we have some callers who want to get into the conversation, so let's do that. Going first to Chicago in line 4. Hello.
Hello. I appreciate the professor's comment that in Europe that it's higher education is seen as a social good. I had a professor once who argued that the reason why the Soviet Union was able to be, given its history, so competitive with the United States in the 60s was its universal education. And basically his theory was that you need a certain level of common education before you can lift up the geniuses and also maintain their work, because otherwise their work is seen as ridiculous or witchcraft, you know, given the use the example of Leonardo da Vinci, where the rest of the community was not at the same level. My question is, here in the United States, I think higher education is often seen as a personal good, and maybe that's why it's not being funded at the levels it needs to be, and maybe at government funding even. So is that the next mission for people in administration, to make it very clear that an educated population is a social good, not an individual benefit?
You are right.
It's actually, yes, that's what we're doing a lot in the development work in fundraising. It's both. I mean, it's also indeed an individual good in some way, but it's what you said, we need to bring a greater awareness what it means for a country, also for an economy, of having an educated population.
Good. Thank you.
All right, thank you. The caller put it beautifully. I'm so embarrassed you put it, the question so well. That should be my job. Let's go to line number 1 in Champaign next. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I very much appreciate the last caller's comment. I'm in an environmental studies side of things, and we desperately need people who are able to think in a PhD style, but we need them to have interdisciplinary capacity. And it's very hard for universities to promote the professorial staff that covers interdisciplinary studies. You start well at the U of I with 30 independent study programs where people can choose to be interdisciplinary. But I would like to see that sort of thing move on and up into the graduate college. And I just would like to see more promotion. We need the technocrats, but we need the generalists too.
Sure. Well, again, comments?
Again, you are absolutely not alone. This is what now, as in my role as graduate dean and many of my colleagues, which we are very much looking at it and working at, how can we promote better interdisciplinary study and therefore interdisciplinary training, because that's what needed both within the university and outside. And that means really looking at the structure of the university, means looking at the budgetary system, needs looking at the evaluation and reward system of faculty, of departments. And also what I want to say from the question before, we really need to work, and that's our role as deans, with our faculty. Yes, students need to be active and be their own manager and not to wait till something is spoon-fed to them. But we need to also with faculty, and often we encounter that my colleagues are afraid they water down the curriculum if they also approach it with thinking that their students will not only become faculty, but we need to move forward. We need real skills which the world needs and which are skills, as we have said before, and they will not take away from an academic training.
I think that we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. My apologies, we have a call that we can't take, but I think we're going to have to wrap it up. I do want to mention one more time that our guests here, Maurice Narad, will be the keynote speaker at a symposium on graduate education that will take place today on the U of I campus, beginning at 1, Illini Union Rooms A and B. Anyone is welcome to attend if you're interested, so do that. Stop by. Our guest, Maurice Narad, is the Associate Dean of the Graduate School at University of Washington at Seattle, and also here with us in the studio is Rebecca Bryant. She is Director of the Career Services Office. That's part of the Graduate College here at U of I in Urbana-Champaign. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Dave,
for being here. We appreciate it. Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nickel, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at thriftynickelads.com. The programming is also made possible by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Registration is not required, and individuals may join anytime. For more information, call 384-5829 or go to their website. That's www.livingyogacenter.net. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about independent film and how it is that two major players in this world, the Sundance Film Festival and the Miramax Studio, helped to make independent film what we think it is today. And our guest for the program will be Peter Biskind. He's written a lot about film. He's done a book about the film of the 70s and now a new one that looks at, indeed, the rise of both Miramax and Sundance and what that has to do with independent film. His book is titled Down and Dirty Pictures, and we'll be talking about that with him in the next part of Focus 580. Also coming up today at noon, as usual, it's the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host. It gets underway with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other sorts of things. We'll bring you up to date on what's happening within the weather at 12:35. And then a 1 o'clock hour, an interview. Celeste Quinn will be talking with the author of a recently published biography of Harriet Tubman. That will be in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. And as I say, as usual, the thing gets underway at noon with news from NPR and from the BBC. Then there'll be sports and weather and a lot of other things. Celeste Quinn is the host. That's here on AM 580 beginning at noon. Right now, though, we're going to take a break, as we usually do at this point. We will have some weather for you at 1 minute past the hour. Weather. News for you from National Public Radio, 1 minute past the hour. But first, we'll get started here with an update on the market. So stay with us.
Thank you very much, Dave. Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. The markets have been very active this morning. We'll get to the specifics in just a second. But if you need to know what's going on in the markets, you should join us tomorrow night, February 11th, for WILO AM 580 Agricultural Outlook meeting. We'll be meeting at the Vermilion County Farm Bureau office in Danville. Our panelists will include Kurt Kimmel, Paul Cooley, Wayne Nelson, and Dan Zwicker. Get you up to date on all you need to know for planning in the spring, as well as what those markets are doing. That means